You know, building a business in any season can be extremely difficult. But now more than ever, we look around and find our lives turned upside down. Everyone is struggling. Our marriages are a mess. Our health is a disaster, physically and mentally. We've lost loved ones, experienced financial stress, and we're exhausted and angry all the time. We have so many labels and opinions, yet we're dealing with more and more pain. That's the inside flap of Dr. John Delony's new book. It's called Own Your Past, Change Your Future. And today I'm blessed, and I think you're going to be blessed, to have him on the show with us. Dr. John Delony is a national best-selling author. He's a mental health and wellness expert and host of the Dr. John Delony Show. He holds two PhDs, one in counselor education and supervision and the other in higher education administration. Before joining Ramsey Solutions, John spent two decades working as a senior leader for multiple universities, a professor and researcher, and crisis responder. Now, as a Ramsey personality, he teaches people how to reclaim their lives from the madness of the modern world. I think the things we talk about on this show, and the things that Dr. Delony will share with us, and the things that are in his book, are some of the absolute most important things that all entrepreneurs, business owners, and leaders need to pay attention to. If we don't pay attention to our own wellness, our own stories that we tell ourselves, we're going to have a real mess on our hands, and we won't be able to take care of anyone else. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. John. Hey, Dr. John, thanks for being on the show.
You got it, man. What's happening, Jay? How we doing?
I'm doing really well. My pastor says blessed and highly favored, or as Dave says, better than I deserve. You know, I was thinking about where to start today, and I'm really thankful to talk to you because I think it's going to create a lot of things for people to think about and hopefully a lot of actions they're going to do. The first time I saw you was on a stage, probably at an Entree Leadership event, and there were thousands of people there. And these events, people that haven't been to are big, you know, rallying, exciting, leadership, growth, development. You're around a lot of thoroughbreds, you know, taking action and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. And then at the end of your talk, I'm looking around the room and everyone is crying. Now, it's not a surprise that I'm crying because I'm a bit of a crier, but everybody else was crying. And I thought, man, there's something here. So I'm curious at the beginning, what made Dave reach out to you? Because Dave strikes me as the kind of guy who is the like, hey, let's pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Let's just charge forward. Let's get this things done. And here comes this guy with multiple PhDs talking about mental health. So How did that evolve?
I think it evolved in two ways. One, I've been trying to avoid media my entire career. Like, so I'd had no social media, no Facebook, no nothing. My whole career was showing up behind closed doors with my students at the universities I worked at, and then suddenly with their parents. And then over time with faculty and staff and community members and things, and then working into counseling. I was showing up behind closed doors when the wheels had fallen off. And when the wheels fall off, when your child passes away, or when your marriage is over, it doesn't matter how wealthy you are. It doesn't matter how big your business is. Everybody gets real human real fast. And so luckily for me, I've always been the youngest guy in the room by a decade. And I just had a ringside seat to watching people get what they wanted, become the president, become the senior vice president, to finally get their law degree or get their medical degree, and then see it all burn to the ground. And so I became over time less and less impressed by the accolades. I was way more impressed by people. I was fascinated by people who could run really hard and then laugh really hard, or run really hard and then just fall asleep at night, or run really hard and their wives or husbands adored them, or their kids adored them. I was like, what? I want that. Because the other stuff comes and goes. And so that's parallel track one. That's just me just doing life and seeing this stuff in real time. And then the fable goes, that's 100% true. I was working in Texas and I took a job at a university here in Nashville. My marriage was hanging on by a dental floss string, right? I mean, it was barely there. And they told me that I had to give a speech 4 days in to about 1,000 people on my vision for the university. And I was like, dude, guys, I don't have a vision. I've been here 4 days. And they said, well, we've already booked the time, and so this is happening. And so I had to fly home for a funeral, and then we flew back. My wife and I took separate flights. I mean, it was a mess. And I got back and I'd forgotten about this talk, and I was like, oh no. And so I cranked it out on my computer, but it was the first time I had done a talk from here, like from my my inside. And it was very much, hey, parents, y'all need to get it together. Kids, you need to get together. And it was really me speaking to myself. And it just so happened that Dave's executive VP was in the audience. And she was tasked with finding people over time who were going to lift up and replace Dave. And she just said to her husband, I'm hiring that guy. And we made it work after that. And so I think behind closed doors, Dave and I see the world. We have very similar values. We both want to help people and we both want to free people from the nonsense. And we both want people to have peace. Where we have fun is we have different beliefs on how to get there sometimes. He thinks sometimes throttling somebody and I think sometimes hugging somebody. Yeah. And so that's the beauty of our relationship. But that's really how it came to be. And now I've got Instagram and Facebook and all this other stuff that I never wanted to be a part of.
Well, I'd like to talk about that at some point. We'll circle back to that because I think that's an interesting thing. You talk a lot about stories and you lead stories with just challenges that you've been through and other people relate to that and they see that and they go, oh gosh, I've got something that's somewhere in that parallel and you're able to connect with them. But it's interesting because you used to be, you know, like you said, behind closed doors so much. And so now you're super much more public. Obviously you're doing book tours and radio and TV and, you know, all these kind of things. So I'm curious how that has affected you, you know, because those are new things to learn if you've not done them before.
Oh man. So the beauty initially is I was so naive. I didn't know you don't challenge Dave Ramsey on the Dave Ramsey show. And so he would say something and I'd say, I don't think that's right. The audience loved it. He loved it. It took some of the people in the booth. They would hold their breath like, what are you doing, man? But so some of it was just naivete. I was in a meeting 6 months into my show, my own show, when we were in a meeting and I was like, what is that? It was on a big like screen. And it was all these different thumbnail pictures of me. And I was like, what is this? And they were like, that's your YouTube channel. And I said, what? I didn't know we had that. I didn't know what a YouTube channel was. And I didn't know that we had tens of thousands of followers. I was like, what is happening? So most of it has been purely naive. And so I was able to early on talk to somebody on the phone the same way I would talk to them when I was in my counseling office or my university office. If you start thinking about how many people are on the other end of that conversation, that's a recipe for disaster. I have struggled with people talking to me in airport bathrooms and things like that. That's just so new for me, man. And that's just part of it. And you can honor somebody by shaking their hand and saying their name.
For sure.
You know, after you've washed your hands for sure.
That's right. Yeah, definitely. Right? For 20 seconds or whatever it is.
Wash your hands, man.
So I was, I think that a lot of entrepreneurial stuff is focused on how do we make more money and how do we, you know, create more freedom and how do we do all these things? And those aren't not inherently bad things. They can be really good things. You can do great things with money. But I think there's this shadow that is the world that you get to talk about a lot. I read this book called Faith-Driven Entrepreneur, and there were some stats in there that absolutely blew my mind. They said entrepreneurs are 2 times more likely to suffer from depression. Entrepreneurs are 3 times more likely to battle with some form of substance abuse. Entrepreneurs are 2 times more likely to have suicidal thoughts, and they're 2 times more likely to be hospitalized for psychiatric problems. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? And then I think that was right around the same time that I kind of first started hearing you on stage. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, there's a real problem here. And I don't think it's talked about a lot. And so I'm curious, like, what your thought is. How do we shine light on these things? And that's obviously a lot of what you're doing. But how do we shine light on these things and encourage other entrepreneurs that don't feel like they have to constantly be like the absolute all-star, you know, in every single moment?
I think you have to socially norm the conversation. You have to have it over and over and over again across the board. And people in positions of leadership have to stop flexing 24/7, 365. And they have to say, hey man, I'm struggling. And so here's what I'm doing about it. And it's the V word, right? It's vulnerable. You got to say as a leader or as an entrepreneur, I'm struggling. I miss my kids. I miss my family. I need some other leaders here to step up because I need to once a week, I'm going to step away and go to see a counselor. If a leader will do that for his team of 5 or her team of 7 or their team of 150, you're going to provide a cascade. You're going to provide a foundation for your team to be well. So to answer your question, we got to start talking about it. And then we got to start doing things about it. Those stats that you describe, I've never heard them, don't surprise me in the least. Mm-hmm. The entrepreneurs that I've run with over the last 20 years have 2 things going against them. One is this, I've got no data to back this up. This is just me running in the wild. Is there's a spirit of me versus the system, and you being against something, I'm going to do something different, or I'm going to go take on the marketplace. If you take that on out of anger or out of frustration or out of, I'm going to step up, that's jet fuel, but it runs out real fast. It's not sustainable. And so you find yourself in the middle of year one in your business, and every year one entrepreneur is unprepared for being underwater for as long as they are. Or it's like skiing, right? And that water's all blasting your face before you get up on the water. So they're unprepared for that. And anger and rage can't take you through that. You have to be on the, you have to be about service. Who am I trying to help here? That drives you through those moments. And then the second thing is entrepreneurs. I was just on the phone with somebody who's an extraordinary entrepreneur that I was helping coach across the country. There's this idea that when I make $150,000 take home, or when my business scales to this, or when I hire this many people, that I will feel a certain way.
Yeah.
And people are unprepared for making their first million, and you still look in the mirror and you feel like crap, and your body doesn't suddenly get a six pack, and your marriage isn't suddenly healed, and your kids don't suddenly like you. And so people are unprepared for the quote unquote feeling of what it feels like to even be successful. And so it doesn't surprise me that people run and run and run, and then they just, their body say, I'm out. Right.
You know, I think about myself in the early years of business, and even still today, if I'm being completely honest, there are so many times where my entire mood is dictated by how our sales chart looks.
Right.
And
because it's a scorecard for you, right?
That's right.
We allow it, allow it to be a scorecard for our value, our success, our worth, right? It's that scorecard.
And I think that's the big thing with entrepreneurs and people that are listening, like you need to think about these things, is like, you are not your business.
Right.
And that, I think that's the thing, is the reality is a lot of businesses at some point fail. And Dave, you know, he started, you know, really what he does now from a place of bankruptcy.
Failure.
From failure.
Of ash. That's right.
Right.
And there's been I think there's 13 or 14 businesses underneath this umbrella, maybe 16. There have been multiple streams over the years that didn't make it, right? Like Dave has a great idea and it doesn't work in the marketplace. And that's just part of doing business, right?
Exactly. And I think that's the crux of it in my head. Again, I don't have data for this, just how I think about it. I know enough entrepreneurs is like, when you become the business, if the business rises and falls, you rise and fall. And there's things we can't control, and there's things that we can. We only got so much time in the day.
Yeah. And it's like Kevin Durant in the NBA finals, he had a terrible season or a terrible finals or a terrible playoffs. Mm-hmm. He's a great shooter. And for a period of, he's one of the greatest shooters that ever has played the game of basketball. But for six games, those shots didn't fall. They just didn't fall. It's not that he's terrible or they didn't fall. And that doesn't mean he's awful and terrible and whatever. It means for that run, and his team's not in the playoffs anymore, right? Here's the crux of that. I mean, the flip side of that is the complaints I hear from entrepreneurs when I have this conversation is, so what am I supposed to do?
That's
just right. Throw my hands up. And so here's what I want your listeners to hear loud and clear. Look at the messes of the world. We need really ambitious, strong, powerful people to start solving some of these problems. Like right now, I got two little kids. I need entrepreneurs out there solving problems. I just need entrepreneurs to know that solving those problems and making $1 trillion or $1 billion or $1 million or $100,000 will not fix your relationship with your dad. It will not solve your marriage. It won't help you overcome the fact that you wore husky jeans when you were a kid and you still see yourself as that pudgy kid. It won't solve that stuff. And so if you can do the healing to become well as a person, it will untether you and allow you to run so much faster than you think you could previously, right? And so I need people to be ambitious, and I need people to know that won't solve you. That won't heal you. And so you got to do that work too.
Yeah, it's... Man, I just have seen so much of that in my own life of just dealing with past issues. And one of the things I love that you talk about, I just read your new book. I actually didn't read it. I listened to it. I don't hardly read books. I really listen to them. And you talk a lot about stories. Yeah. And I love that, because I'm a big story guy. And I think it helps people connect. So you talk about this idea of owning your past and changing your future. I think that for a long time, I operated from a place of, I'm just going to plow forward. Like I'm not going to worry about all those things. I'm just going to like, they're going to be there. It's fine. I'm past all of that and I'm just going to ignore it. I'm going to stuff it down in there and it'll just go away, you know? And so talk about this idea of owning your past. Cause I think that's something that I did not do, maybe still don't do as well as I needed to for a very long time.
So what we're finding out with trauma research and with neurological research, the easiest way I can explain it is your body is scanning its environment 24/7. Your brain is 365, always, always scanning the environment to look for things that are threats. They're going to take you out, right? And your body has one job. Every cell in the human body has one job, and that's to get to tomorrow and then to get to the next day. If you're super stressed, it will smoke a cigarette because the nicotine and the chemicals help you feel better right now, even though it's going to cost you tomorrow, because the whole goal is just get through today. And so we can get to tomorrow and then we can get to the next day. Right. And so when it experiences a threat, let's say you're a kid and you hear dad drive up the driveway, you know, dad's coming home a little bit late, which means he's probably had a few drinks, which means either I got him and have to distract him and get between him and mom or him and little sister or him and little brother, or I need to get really small. I just need to get small and kind of back up. And I'll just go in my room, shut the door. Your body puts a GPS pin in as little of things as the noise of the car coming up the driveway. And you fast forward that to you hear your boss walking down the hall 20 years later. Your wife drives up the driveway and your body begins to tell you, you should back up. You need to just disappear. You need to get ready to fight because she's coming home a little bit late. And so that the things that kept you alive, the things that helped you deal with childhood stuff, getting on a bus where kids made fun of you, getting on a bus where nobody talked to you, going to a football practice where coaches were going to yell at you. Your body just puts GPS pins in all these stories and they continue to solve for those stories into your 40s, 50s, 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever. And that's how you pass generational trauma on to your kids and them to their kids. And so what healing has to be about, you have to acknowledge these stories that you grew up with. You have to acknowledge these stories of the things you've been through, the things people have said to you, the things you have been told, so that you can tell your body in the present, we're okay now. And now we have to ask ourselves, what is moving forward healing going to look like? Yes, somebody treated me different because of the color of my skin, and they're going to continue. It's going to continue to happen. Period, at the end of that sentence. What am I going to do now? Am I going to live in this way or am I going to run free, right? What is that going to look like? Yes, you were abused. That happened. It's devastating. And there's a period at the end of that sentence. Now, what are we going to do? Are we going to continually live our life as this is all you're ever going to be? You're always going to be the worst thing that ever happened to you. Or are you going to live into something brand new and create something different for you and those who come after you? That's and as a culture, that's where we are. We have to ask ourselves, okay, what now? What are we going to do now?
Well, and I think the thing that's so interesting about that to me is I see the extremes. I had an old pastor used to say people tend to fall off one side of the cliff or the other.
And I think that's a great line.
I think the extremes are one side says, you know, you're a snowflake if you even talk about mental health and who cares? Like you just need to, you know, buckle up and get moving. And the other side says, hey, if you're not doing yoga 8 times a day and drinking, you know, this special herbal tea, then you're hardly even taking care of yourself. You know,
you hate yourself and your community. That's in the right. environment.
That's yeah. right. Exactly.
Yeah. So ultimately this book ultimately came from that place is we have a culture that gives you two paths. That's it. It's mm-hmm. either you're the worst thing that ever happened to you. You're always going to be a victim. You're always going to be classified by the worst thing that's happened to you or the worst thing you've done. You'll always be a cancer survivor, an abuse survivor, a racism. You're always going to be that. And because you have no power or autonomy because somebody hurt you or because you hurt yourself, somebody's got to come rescue you. You are mm-hmm. pathetic. You are broken. And somebody's got to come fix you. Usually some sort of government entity or some sort of do-gooder nonprofit entity. The other side is the other extreme, like you mentioned, which is if you have a feeling, you're a coward. Shut your mouth and suck it up and crush it, mm-hmm. kill it and drill all those. And I'm calling bullcrap on both. And yeah. this book is really the new third way, which is you have to acknowledge how your body feels. And then you have to ask yourself, what am I going to do now? I didn't feel like working out this morning. I just didn't. I'm tired. And I went anyway. Mm-hmm. And last week, I really wanted to get down there and work out. and my body was kaput. I was traveling. And so the best thing I could do for my body, the hardest thing I could do for myself was rest. And so I slept in. And so it's knowing the difference and then moving forward.
You know, you talk about this idea of like changing the narrative of your own life. One of the things Don Miller says that I like is he says, fate is a horrible author. And instead, I think that's kind of the direction that you're heading, which is like, you have to be intentional. You have to decide. You're pre-decided that exercising is good for you. And most of the time, that's something you should do. Right. And so you've just made the decision. And so that's what you're going to do, regardless of how you feel in that instance. And at the same time, we also need to know. I remember, I think I was watching a YouTube video. It might have been from that Redefining Anxiety book that you did. We might have been talking about another podcast. You're talking about this idea of like a smoke alarm and your anxiety. Yes. You know what I'm talking about? Can you talk through that? Because I think that was a really helpful analogy.
Yeah. So, let me back up real quick right before we talk about anxiety.
Sure.
Here's what was really helpful for me. I've never heard that quote by Don, but I love it. We really dump too much into the phrase, that's just the way it's going to be. Mm-hmm. My friend Justin McRoberts, he wrote a book. He hates the phrase, it is what it is, because that's not true. It's not. It doesn't have to be. James Clear, I read Atomic Habits, and it's an excellent book, and it sold 8 trillion copies, and it's great. But there was a light bulb moment for me in that book when he talks about living into an identity. And we're so obsessed with goals and we're so obsessed with accomplishments and finish lines. And those just move, especially for an entrepreneur. The moment you make $1 million, you start thinking, how can I make 2? Mm-hmm. And so his suggestion is when you're trying to change your life, which again, you change your life 1 minute at a time, 1 habit at a time, is create a new identity, like you mentioned. I'm a guy who exercises. Really, it's bigger than that. I'm a guy who's a steward of my body, which means most of the time I need to move and sometimes I need to rest. And most of the time I eat pretty good and occasionally I need to get off the rails. And most of the time I need to focus on intimacy with my wife and my kids. So I'm a steward of my body. That's who I am. And so these other, the behaviors are in service to that identity. And that's what we can change. And I love that idea. So circling back to anxiety, I think our culture's so bananas to me. That little book was a result of me popping off on the air. I was on the radio show with Dave and 2 or 3 people in a row called about anxiety. I'm struggling from anxiety. And finally, I just said, hey, anxiety is not the problem. Yeah. Anxiety is just an alarm system letting you know that you're not okay. Your body, if you're anxious, your body's working pretty good. Mm-hmm. And we took the headphones off and Dave said, you need to write that down. And so we wrote a 60-page book, and Jay, you've seen it. It's supposed to be a business card, right? That we hand out, and it made the bestseller list. We're going to end up changing because it was such a new concept and I couldn't believe it. Here's the deal. All anxiety is a smoke alarm in your kitchen. It's just letting you know that you're usually one of 3 things. Now people have neurological issues and brain lesions and things, but most of the time, it's just simply letting you know you're disconnected, you're out of relationship, your body has recognized it's alone, and it knows that that is not, you can't live like that, or that you're unsafe, right? You're in an abusive marriage, you're in an abusive work relationship, you're not safe, your neighborhood's not safe, you have food insecurity, you live in poverty, or 3 is autonomy. You don't have control or say in what comes next. And here's the ugly truth. If you owe somebody money, your frontal lobe may be able to do the math on what's a good rate of return and I'm getting good at this. Your amygdala, the part of your brain that's scanning the environment 24/7 that triggers the fight or flight response, knows you don't get to decide what you do tomorrow. Bank of America does. You don't get to decide what you do tomorrow. Toyota Motor Company financing wing gets to decide what you do tomorrow. It knows you're not safe. If you don't have a job, you will die. You will be homeless. And that thing starts sounding the alarm. So if you look at your debt profile and you're anxious, of course, because your body knows, not your little thinking brain who's got it all figured out in the spreadsheet. Your body knows you're not safe. And so one of those 3 things, 2 or 3 of those things are out of whack. And just think about the last couple of years. Isolation was a virtue. Right? The greatest thing I could do for my community was to stay away from other people. Mm. And that little 6-year-old girl without a mask might kill me, or I might hug the wrong person at church, this elderly woman, and I might kill her. So the best thing to do is to stay away. Well, our bodies aren't designed for that, man. And it started ringing the alarms. And so when you look around and we're not safe and we can't go to work and we're the government or whoever's telling us what we can. All of a sudden, everyone's anxious. And I look around and think, well, yeah, we're supposed to be. So if you run to the kitchen and take the batteries out of the alarm or duct tape a pillow over it just to mute it, your house is still on fire.
Right.
And so don't take the batteries out of the alarm. Go on the front yard and figure out what's on fire. Put the fire out and the alarm will shut itself off, man.
Yeah. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to give a talk to a bunch of entrepreneurs. And I was actually talking on work-life balance. And what they didn't know, when I woke up that morning, really about 2 weeks prior to that, every morning I was waking up and I was just so sad and overwhelmed. And just, I had this so much weight on me. And I'm sitting in my room preparing for a talk on work-life balance, crying, not like a little crying, like crying, you know, to my wife. And she's like, and I knew what the reality was. I just put too much on but that analogy helped me a lot because I got to go, hold on, what is actually wrong right now? Like, let me step outside. Let me look at the house. And there are some things that are on fire. I've put too much weight on the truck, you know, and it can't drive anymore. And I can't, you know, and so as a result, you got to go, okay, now what matters most? What's the next most important thing? And so action is really important. I think, you know, we can talk about these things all day long, but the question becomes, like, for entrepreneurs, leaders, business owners that are listening, what are they going to do about it? Everybody has felt like this, whether they admit it or not. And if they haven't, they just haven't been in business long enough or alive long enough.
Or they're lying.
They will.
Yeah,
that's right. Or they're lying. That happens too. And you talk about very early in the book, kind of five steps that people can take to help become well. So let's walk through those kind of and give people a framework for what to do about these things.
Yeah. So I think it's important to note, if I'm watching TV at 2 a.m. and you're flipping channels and it's like 7 ways to new abs or 14 ways to the new, I just skip it by. What an idiot, right? So these five quote unquote steps or what, they weren't even in the book. The editor got to the end and she said, you realize you've created a path through here for people to be well. And I was like, no, I didn't. That's not how I think. And she's like, no, you for sure did. And so she looped back and I was like, oh man, you're right. These are just principles you can put in your back pocket. What you did in real time is the cornerstone of being well. And it's important to know there will never be, Dave and I laugh about this. You know, people come into a debt-free scream. Like they scream, I am debt-free. There will never be a anxiety-free scream or a stress-free scream. Because the moment you scream that, you're going to walk out in the parking lot and someone's going to call you and says, hey, your mom's got cancer, right? That's life. You will find yourself on your bed in tears. That's life.
Yeah.
Now, what are we going to do? And you were brilliant because you sat down and you were curious. You didn't let the old stories take off on you. I'm crying because I'm a loser and I always screw this thing up. And every time I've got a history of failure. That's not what you did. You were curious about what's my body trying to tell me right now.
Oh, and one more thing on that.
Too much on the truck, right?
One more thing on that too is like I for years buried myself so much in business. I didn't have anybody else I could lean on. And that's why I leaned only on my wife.
Right.
And now, mostly thanks to her, honestly, she's helped me build good friends. I have a few good guys that I could shoot a message to and say, hey, I am not okay. I need you to pray for me. I need you to check on me. And I need you to hold me accountable that I'm not putting too much on my plate.
Yes.
And that was a game changer.
I cannot count the number of entrepreneurs, wives, and husbands I've met who feel like trash cans. All they do is get, because entrepreneurs are, it's a lonely gig and you don't want to dump that on your employees if you have one or two or seven or eight. And some many entrepreneurs' employees are high school kids or, you know, college kids. And so you just go home and tell your wife how awful everything is or how bad this was or how, and they are not equipped to handle that. That's not their job, right? You need a tribe, you need a gang, you need a couple of guys, three or four or five guys that are going to walk through life with you. Four or five women are going to walk through life with you. So circling back, the first thing you have to do if you want to get well is you got to own the stories. I have to say out loud, I got to write these things down. This happened to me. Stories I was born into. And hey, here's a simple thing. The stories are the stories you're born into, the stories you were told, the stories about the things you've done or things that really happened. And all of those stories ultimately become the stories you tell yourself. Here's how that works in real time. Say you grew up in a house that didn't believe in God, or you grew up in a house that told you God is your best friend and he is looking out for you. And if you follow him, the greatest things are going to happen. Or you grew up in a house where they said, God is watching you. And if you say the wrong thing, he will strike you. You will burn in hell for eternity, and he will smile because he got rid of justice, right? All three of those are stories you were just born into about God. And if you grow up thinking that there's some sort of deity that's just clearing the path for you to get a great rate on your mortgage and to make tons of money and to have a beautiful spouse, and you're going to enter into life in a certain way. And if you are shot off thinking that there's some deity that's tracking you and following you, dude, your body's going to be running hot with cortisol and adrenaline 24/7, 365. And suddenly over time, your parents tell you things, and your coaches tell you things, and your teachers tell you things, or your abuser tells you things. Over time, it becomes the stories you tell yourself. Of course, I can't do that. Of course, I stink at that. Of course, all I'm good for is my body. Of course, I'm less than. And those stories carry us through. So you've got to own your stories. Somebody told me this, and it wasn't right. This happened to me, and it was wrong. Full stop. There's a period at the end of that sentence, and I can't go back and edit it because it happened. But I'm going to stop trying to mess with it, and I'm going to write a new sentence moving forward. So that's number one. You got to own the stories. Number two, you got to acknowledge reality. Most of us didn't mean to gain an extra 40 pounds. We didn't. Most of us didn't mean to, who are married, we didn't mean to wake up and it's been 3 months since we've slept with our partners. We just suddenly it happened. We got busy. We didn't mean to yell at our kids regularly over time. We didn't mean to spend 80 hours a week. It was just going to be this 1 week, and it turned into 3 weeks, and now it's turned into a year. And now my kid doesn't even ask me to go fishing anymore because he knows dad's busy. We don't mean to stare at our phones too much, and our six-year-old little daughter's just saying, hey, do you see me? Do you see me? Do you see me? So we have to acknowledge reality. This is where we are. It's kind of like Dave says, you've got to write down who you owe money to. You got to write that down and look at it and say, this is how much money I owe. This is just owning reality. This is the world I've created for myself. And then I can move forward. And there is no, this is number three, there is no such thing as long-term behavior change. It doesn't exist when it's done in isolation. You can white knuckle your way to losing 50 pounds. It will come back if you do it by yourself. You can white knuckle your way through, I quit drinking for 90 days, for 120 days. If you don't have a group of people to do life with, that addiction will find its way either back, or it will manifest in another way. So before I tell people to go change your actions and change your thoughts and do different things, I tell them you got to get a group of people with you. And sometimes that's a therapist. Sometimes, like you mentioned, it's a group of friends. Sometimes that is a good pastor at a church, small group. I don't care where or what it is. You got to have people in your life that you do life with. And then number four, number five are rather relatively interchangeable. You've got to start changing your actions. You got to look at your life and say, I've got to do something different, and I've got to start thinking different things. And those things work together. I think one of the great, I don't say failures, because that's a stupid word to use here, but one of my frustrations with the mental health world over the last 100 years, of which I'm a part of, is that we've told everyone, if you get the right thoughts in the right order, everything's okay. You just need to reorder. We need to get the right thoughts in the right place, and you need to get all the right stories in the right place, and then we can go on and have a good life. And that's simply false. That's part of it. You also have to start acting differently. You have to choose to do something different with your anger. You got to choose to move your body. You got to choose to eat differently. You got to choose to stop texting people back when you're married to somebody else. You got to choose to act differently. At the same time, you're working on different thoughts. And that's when how your body begins to alt and shift and change. And now you're on the path to wellness.
Yeah. You know, I struggled with that a lot for a long time because, you know, I think some of these behaviors, you talked about James Clear, like some of the just habits that we have are so ingrained in how we've always done it. You know,
right.
Like when I get sad, I eat
yep,
or I
that's
drink
right.
or
that's
I,
right.
whatever, you know, and I just, and it makes me feel better. It does.
It does. Like, it really
it feels
does.
There's better a chemical when you
thing.
Eat a donut,
it makes you feel absolutely. You
know? At least for a little while.
For a minute. That's
and,
right.
And I think that I, for so long, have just not had a framework to talk about those things. And it feels unmanly to do it.
That's right. Know? That's right.
And I was dealing with just, you know, I'm the oldest of five kids. And, you know, I've got two parents that we've got all kind of past family issues like everybody else does. And I was dealing with some struggles, and I read this book by C.S. Lewis called A Grief Observed. And if anybody's struggling with grief, I'd highly encourage this book. At the beginning, he starts with this quote. He says, "No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear. I'm not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. the same fluttering in my stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I keep on swallowing. At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There is a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It's so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be about me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not me. And that's C.S. Lewis, like one of the brightest minds that maybe has ever walked the earth. And if he can feel like that and it's normal, I can feel like that and it's normal, but I don't have to stay there. And I think that's kind of the crux of what you're talking about taking action. What I'd love to wrap up on, I know we're kind of landing the plane, is when people get in that place where they go, okay, I know I need to do something about this and I need to take action, but I'm just struggling actually doing it. Like, what would you encourage them with to actually push them in the right direction, if you will?
Ah, man. A couple of things. One, I think if you're a person of faith, if you're a person of a Christian faith, I think there's no better example than Jesus going to the garden and getting down on his face and saying, can we do it another way?
Yeah.
That's him acknowledging, I don't like this. This is, I'm owning the story. I know the path here. I'm owning reality. I don't want this. Like, I see what's coming here. And then I've got to get up and go do what I got to do. Mm-hmm. And so there's the change in your actions, change your thoughts. It's rarely easy. In fact, it almost never is, but we got to go do that. Or we can just keep grabbing another donut and another donut and another donut. So this idea has been cast in 50 million different ways throughout great mental health books. And so what I'm saying right now is nothing new. But here's what I look for in my life. And I'm trying to teach this to my kids. I look for the gap between stimulus and response, the gap between I want to grab that donut and actually grabbing that donut. And the longer I can make that gap, the better I am at changing my actions and changing my thoughts. So some of it starts with, I keep reaching for its awareness, like you mentioned. You're owning reality there, right? You're acknowledging reality. I keep grabbing donuts and candy when I'm stressed. I cannot have that in my house. My wife is a serial killer because she can get a bag of jelly beans and eat three, just three jelly beans. I found, like, a couple months ago, it was when I was writing the book, I found like a bag of half eaten gummy candy she'd hidden from me. And I was like, what is this? And she's like, I don't know. I just grab a couple every day. And I was like, who are you? Like, I think she sacrifices babies or something. I can't do that. I cannot have that in my home. And so part of, I'm not going to moralize it or make it a character issue or a weakness. No, I'm just not going to have it around. Some people have to do that with alcohol. Some people have to do that with cable TV. Some people have to do that with old girlfriends' phone numbers, right? Some people have to fill in the blank with what your thing is. But we have to create an environment where we can be successful. And then I'm going to constantly lean into that gap. Somebody cuts me off. I can't stand bad drivers. It drives me crazy, Jay. Somebody cuts me off and I start to grab the steering wheel and I just stop. Here's the word that gets me. The two words. These are two words. Be curious about your body and practice. Mm. Consider these things not moral failures or character issues. You just simply don't have the tools. And so I'm going to start practicing. LeBron James, who's in the finals right now?
I don't even know. I'm horrible with these things. My son would know.
Some shooter is going to be practicing tonight. The NBA finals are coming. Jason Tatum's going to be, the Celtics are playing. He's going to take 200 shots tonight, practice before the game starts, so that when something big happens, like the NBA finals, his body's going to be primed and his mind's going to be primed. And so when I'm driving, I'm going to practice doing one of the two things. Somebody cuts me off. I can either say, that idiot's on drugs, trying to kill everybody, probably listens to heavy metal music, that idiot. Or I can be curious about a guy cut me off and it scares me. I can exhale and say, God, help him get to the hospital before his wife passes. Let him be able to see her one more time. I get to pick which story that I choose to make up about that dude. And so I'm going to choose the one that doesn't kill me sooner and that doesn't make me more likely to get in a wreck because his life goes on either way. He's just driving around. I'm going to choose that story, man. Yeah. And so I'm going to practice over and over and over, not yelling at my kids. I'm going to practice showing up for my wife. I'm going to practice putting my phone away. And when I don't, I'm going to be conscious of it. I'm going to be curious about it. every time I come home, I pull my phone out because I don't feel like I'm being a good dad. Mm. So I'm gonna put my phone away, and now I've got to get a couple of tools to learn how to be a better dad, right? I'm gonna lean into it that way.
I love that idea of just practicing what you actually want to achieve. And it seems so simple, but you got to actually do it. You need people to hold you accountable. One of the things that's been most helpful for me is not just that micro stuff, but also like the big vision stuff is I always say, like, I can close my eyes and I can see my life when I'm 70 years old. I can see the porch I'm sitting on, and I can see the cigar that's sitting next to me and the wife that's sitting next to me, same wife I'm married to now. I can see my kids.
She's way different. This one's got black hair.
That's right. I can see the kids in the yard. I can see the grandkids. I can see them playing on the boat in the river. Like, I can see those things. And the question becomes, are the things that I'm doing today going to lead me to that point then? Yes or no?
That's right. That's right. And can I tell you this? Where a lot of us get hung up when we do that exercise is, I hate to speak this, and I'm just going to use that as an example. Okay. Sure. Let's say, your wife, her hair turns stone gray.
Yeah.
Right. Or you have two kids who choose to not have any grandchildren.
Mm, yeah.
Our tendency is, as we get to be 50 and 60 on the way to 70, as our picture that we've had in our head that we've been working towards, the reality of that picture starts to crystallize and materialize. We get frantic. We start to feel like we have failed. Mm. And so an important part of the journey is grieving. Oh, I thought I would have 25 employees and $5 million in revenue by this point. I don't. That doesn't mean I'm a failure. And my body is starting to crank up the failure machine. Mm. I'm not failing. Or maybe I have failed and I need to reconsider my business. Or maybe my wife left me and there's a different woman on the porch. I need to, you know what I mean? So it's constantly balancing reality of your world versus where you want to go, and knowing that where you want to go is going to morph and change. It's going to be different over time, right? And being okay with that.
You know, selfishly, that might be the most valuable thing that I hear this week. So I'm really thankful for you and your time. I think the things that you're talking about are wildly important. I think they are changing people's lives. I think they are saving people's lives, and you're doing good work. Dr. John, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, I'm grateful, Brother Jay. Thank you.